Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abba Ayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abba Ayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, March 9th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast. Later on in our program, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the continuing resistance efforts by Palestinians in Gaza. Liberal feminism has been criticized over the failure to express solidarity with Palestinians. Demonstrations were held across the world on International Women's Day yesterday, and violence continues in the Caribbean nation of Haiti. In the second and third hours, we present our latest installment on International Women's History Month with a review of the lifetimes and contributions of Anna Julia Cooper, who lived between 1858 and 1964. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the music of Umm Kulthum and her orchestra. This is from a concert in 1968. Let's listen in. Thank you.
صحيح الهوى خلاب ما ما احسبش Oh, Thank you. Thank you. الحب وراه
Kalsum Orchestra from the North African state of Egypt from a live concert in 1968. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And today is Saturday, March 9th, 2024. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And if you'd like to have access to today's program, all you need to do is go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program, and we'll give you information at the conclusion of this segment on how you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire. Our lead story deals with the current situation in Palestine. The Palestinian resistance in Gaza has now marked its 155th day of ongoing confrontations against the Israeli occupation forces in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian resistance is engaging in ongoing confrontations with the Israeli occupation to confront the aggression on Gaza, causing human and material losses among the Israeli occupation forces. The operations come in response to the Israeli atrocities committed against the Palestinian people, and that's according to Al-Mahdeen Television. The Al-Qassam Brigade, that goes on, the military wing of the Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas, published footage of the remnants and remains of the occupation army's vehicles after they were targeted in the areas of the city of Khan Yunis, south of the Gaza Strip. In recent days, Khan Yunis has witnessed ambushes and direct targeting of Israeli soldiers. The Al-Qassam Brigades proudly declared the successful interception of two Israeli quadcopter drones, which were engaged in intelligence gathering operations in the vicinity of the Al-Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. The Israeli occupation forces admitted to the death of one of his officers, where fierce battles were taking place with the Palestinian resistance on more than one axis. The Israeli military revealed that the dead officer was a major of the special forces. In a joint operation, the Al-Quds brigades, representing the military prowess of the Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine, joined forces with the Al-Mujahideen brigades. Together, they launched a direct attack using 107 rockets targeting Israeli occupation troops and vehicles in the Abu Urabin area of the Al-Zaytun neighborhood. The Al-Quds Brigade's media outlet released footage documenting the artillery and military fortification of the Al-Quds fighters on the gathering of Israeli occupation soldiers east of the central governorate of the Gaza Strip. The Al-Mujahideen Brigades have affirmed they captured a quadcopter drone equipped with intelligence capabilities and assigned tasks intercepted while conducting operations west of the Tel al-Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City. The Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades, the military wing of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, announced the targeting of Israeli occupation vehicles and sites in the eastern area of Jabalia, in the northern area of the Strip, using mortar shells. They emphasized that this was in response to the Israeli atrocities committed against the Palestinian people. In retaliation, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade confirmed the direct targeting of an Israeli military vehicle using a rocket-propelled grenade shell at the advancing axis south of the Al-Zaytun neighborhood. This deliberate action serves as a stark message to the occupying forces, stressing, quote, "There's no safety for you on our land," unquote. Furthermore, they unveiled footage depicting their fighters conducting operations, launching a barrage of 60-millimeter mortar shells at a gathering of Israeli soldiers stationed near the Erez site, situated to the north of the Gaza Strip. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. In an article by Tala Alayia, reprinted from Al-Mahdeen, it says this article is a historical analysis of liberalism, how it is imperial by nature, with a focal lens on the counter-revolutionary nature of feminist movements that do not show support for the Palestinians. In Malcolm X's analysis of white liberals, he explained that the liberal can only be distinguished from the conservative by his deceit, veiled as support to the oppressed that will later exploit his vulnerability and suffering in the power play of political gain. The liberal's solidarity, hence, is but a ploy to gain the favor of the oppressed, exploit his struggle, and then throw him back into the ditch he promised to pull him out of. In this case, liberal feminism can also be considered as a branch of what Malcolm X highlighted, specifically in the case of Gaza and the events that unfolded since October 7, 2023. Liberal feminism, by definition, focuses on achieving gender equality through political and legal reform within the framework of liberal democracy and is informed by a human rights perspective. However, the paradigm encompasses two major gaps, the essence of liberal democracy and the flawed human rights perspective. as both stem from a capitalist, white supremacist, exploitative foundation. They cannot be considered to build equality. This is also because essentially when we refer to liberalism, we refer to what Malcolm X laid, the flawed, treacherous nature of liberal solidarity that ultimately always goes back to its oppressive roots. This is what we see when liberal Westerners use the Palestinian flag to show solidarity with Gaza, but demonize its resistance by accusing them of the recurrently refuted accusations of rape and the demonstration of what they consider to be intersexual feminist defense. Since the New York Times, a pro-Israel news outlet, published the narrative that Hamas fighters sexually assaulted female Israeli captives, pro-Palestinian Westerners protesters decided to showcase their activism and solidarity by condemning the Israeli military offensive in Gaza, but by simultaneously even more vigorously condemning what they claim Hamas did. Before we discuss what their activism entails, two matters must be dissected: why the New York Times narrative is false and why the West cannot seem to let it go. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, the largest demonstrations in solidarity with Palestinian women yesterday were held in London, where over 450,000 people came out to the American embassy raising Palestinian flags and banners demanding a ceasefire and an end to the aggression. Protests and demonstrators have continued on a global scale in support of Gaza and condemnation of the ongoing genocide in Palestine. Nearly 450,000 demonstrators gathered in London demanding an end to the United Kingdom's complicity in the Israeli aggression on Gaza and call for the cessation of the country's military, political, and financial support to Israel. Numerous cities across the globe saw mass demonstrations denouncing the Israeli genocide, which has caused a death toll of over 30,000 Palestinians. The largest demonstrations were in London, where over 450,000 people came out to the American embassy raising Palestinian flags and banners demanding a ceasefire and an end to the aggression in the fifth pro-Palestinian rally in London so far this year. And with that, we want to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal by discussing the situation in the Caribbean island nation of Haiti. According to a New York Times, according to an Associated Press report, rotting fruit, withered vegetables, empty water jugs, and spent gas canisters now stock the stores and stands that serve the poor people of Haiti, a consequence of the unrelenting gang attacks that have paralyzed the country for more than a week and left it with dwindling supplies of basic goods. The terrifying violence as anti-government gangs battle police in the streets has crippled the fragile economy and made it extremely difficult for many of the country's most vulnerable to feed themselves. The main port in the capital of Port-au-Prince closed down, stranding scores of containers full of food and medical supplies at a time when United Nations officials say half the country's more than 11 million inhabitants don't have enough to eat, and 1.4 million are starving. Grocery stores and upscale parts of the capital remain stocked, but their goods are out of reach to most in a country where most people earn less than $2 a day. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. That is going to conclude this segment, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. www.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, March 9th, 2024, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Ruler of my heart, robber of my soul, where can you be? I wait patiently. My heart cries out. When you're lost, so go and get rough. Come back, come back, come back. I've had enough. Make me a queen. Happy again. Hear my cry. He's my king.
Thomas, the soul legend of New Orleans, doing the track entitled Ruler of My Heart. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, March 9th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. March is International Women's History Month, and today we're going to focus on the lifetimes and contributions of Anna Julia Cooper, who lived between 1858 and 1964. She was a feminist literary figure, a Pan-Africanist, and educator. Let's listen to a symposium that was held at Hillsdale College on the lifetimes and contributions of Anna Julia Cooper.
I am Benjamin Couch Payne. I'm a project officer with the Barney Charter School Initiative, and I'm also one of the founding members of the Anna Julia Cooper Public Charter School effort here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the Alan P. Kirby Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship, which is the campus of Hillsdale College in our nation's capital. Hillsdale was founded in 1844 with a mission to furnish all persons who wish, irrespective of race, religion, or gender, a liberal arts education, specifically aimed at developing the minds and improving the hearts of its pupils. The man standing right over here, knowingly or not, set all the events in motion to have us here this evening, and he can also sing. So as a result, I'm not going to waste any more time. This is Mr. Roger Moss, Jr., accompanied by Hillsdale College junior Lorena Clements on the piano, performing a piece composed by Margaret Bonds with lyrics from a poem by Langston Hughes, which is "The Negro Speaks of Rivers." And with that, I officially welcome you to the second annual symposium on liberal arts education and African American history, a tribute to Anna Julia Cooper. And now I turn it over to the co-founder of this event, Mr. David Witham.
Good afternoon. Right. So since we're ultimately talking about the classics, why don't we start this afternoon and see how many people have been practicing their Latin. Ready? Salvete. Oh, I've got a few. About caerete. I got one, kare. There we go. It says hello in Latin and in Greek. Okay, so I am David Whiffen. I'm an English instructor at Savannah Technical College, and I have the great privilege of moderating tonight. And I want to start by thanking all the people who made this afternoon, I keep saying this night, but this afternoon possible, starting with Mr. Benjamin Payne. He won't admit it, but he did most of the work to get this together. Everything that we're doing today, it started, in fact, in front of an elevator in the school that he and I used to teach, or I used to teach at, and he used to be the director of. When he stopped me in front of the elevator after I had spoken at a conference somewhere far away from Savannah, and he said, you know, that kind of thing, you would get this if you know Mr. Payne, by the way. He leaned in and he said, you know, that thing you do, we should do that here. I said, okay. So we wrote the grants and called the people and were able to have the first annual symposium on liberal education and African American history last year in Savannah, Georgia, and that was for William Sanders Scarborough, who I hope, and if you don't know, I hope that you will learn about him if you do know, outstanding. And we had Dr. Michelle Ronick and Dr. Patrice Rankin of the University of Richmond and Dr. Michael Benjamin. It was an outstanding event. So we decided that we had to do it again this year, and it had to happen. I'm not a superstitious person, but I knew that it had to happen because everything that could go wrong along the way went wrong along the way, and yet I'm still standing here right now, including even today when Mr. Moss and I had spent 3 hours sitting at the airport while American Airlines did some paperwork to get our plane off of the ground. So we've had quite the experience. So please, a round of applause for Mr. Benjamin Payne before we get started. Of course, I also want to thank our sponsors because tonight or this afternoon would not have happened without them as well. The Society for Classical Studies, Classics Everywhere Initiative, the Classical Association of the Middle West and South, their Committee for the Promotion of Latin, the Classical Association of the Atlantic States, of course, where we are right now, the Alan P. Kirby Jr. Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship. They all provided the means by which we could make this happen. And so thank you very, very much to all of them. I also want to acknowledge some of our guests tonight. So we've met Mr. Roger Moss and myself and Mr. Payne. I do want to thank, of course, our speakers, and I'll introduce each of them individually, but Dr. Shirley Moody Turner, who is at the University of Pennsylvania. We'd like to say thank you and welcome to her. Dr. Kara Olivia Heron, who is from Howard University, also will be speaking tonight, and I'll introduce each of them in a little bit more detail. I also want to acknowledge Dr. Mike Morica, who is the head of the Anna Julia Cooper Episcopal School in Richmond, Virginia. And some of the students from that school provided, and I want to make sure I'm touching the right one, I provided this collage of Anna Julia Cooper. So thank you for being here tonight, and thank you for having your students do this. Can I please get a round of applause? Outstanding work. I'm also pleased to say my wife, unfortunately, could not be here tonight. She is Vanessa Whiffen, though, and she has done, she has gotten me together, and so that's a good start. But she also, among her many talents, is an artist, and she painted this oil painting of Anna Julia Cooper specifically for this event, and so I want to thank her as well. If we could get a round of applause. She can hear you in Savannah, I hope. All right, well, let's turn to our first speaker, and that is Dr. Shirley Moody Turner, who is going to speak to us tonight about the education of the underprivileged, Anna Julia Cooper's commitment to transformative education in our nation's capital. To give you a little bit of background, and I have it on my phone, I'm one of those people. Dr. Shirley Moody Turner is a scholar, educator, and writer who has been conducting research and teaching on the life, writings, and work of Anna Julia Cooper for almost two decades. She was first introduced to Cooper's writings as a graduate student and found particular resonance and inspiration in Cooper's stated devotion to, quote, the education of the underprivileged. Moody Turner is the author of Black Folklore and the Politics of Racial Representation, in which she examines Cooper's relationship to early black folklore studies, and she has published widely, lectured, and given interviews on the reach and continued significance of Cooper's work. She is the co-founder of the Anna Julia Cooper Society, the founding director of the Cooper Du Bois Mentoring Program, and in 2017, she worked with the Moreland Spinger Research Center at Howard University to create the Anna Julia Cooper Digital Collection. She is an associate professor of English and African American Studies at Penn State University and is currently a fellow at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University, where she is completing her next book, privately printed, Anna Julia Cooper and the Gender Politics of Black Publishing. So let's please welcome Dr. Shirley Moody Turner.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay. No? Okay. See, I need someone to let me know. Okay, how's that? It's better? Okay. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Benjamin as well. Just a tremendous amount of work to bring this event together and along with the larger initiative. And I think it's just really, really exciting what you're doing with the Anna Julia Cooper Public Charter School Initiative. That was wrong, Charter School Initiative. And, you know, I'm just excited to see how things develop and glad to be here and to be able to be a part of it. And it's really great to be here with this group tonight. So many brilliant people here. This is really exciting. I want to take a minute and just acknowledge a few influences on the work that I've done. I think this is a really important practice. I'm going to give credit to this practice of giving credit from the Colored Conventions Project. I don't know if people have heard of it, but one of the things they do is always, you know, there's one person standing in front of you, but there's a lot of people who have contributed to that work. And I think, too, about the, you know, hashtag Slight Black Women, we want to make sure that we're acknowledging the people who have contributed. So I just want to take a minute, and I want to first say, yes, Mary Helen Washington was my advisor at the University of Maryland. She was the person who introduced me to Anna Julia Cooper. She did the 1988 Schomburg edition of A Voice from the South, and not too long ago, she actually sent me a biography that was given to her by Paul Philip Cook, who did a very early biography of Cooper, and Mary Helen passed it on to me. Paul Philip Cook worked with Louise Hutchinson on the Cooper exhibit with Anacostia Museum, and that, to this day, is really some of the most incredible foundational work on Cooper. A lot of what we are doing here with Cooper, talking about Cooper, know about Cooper, wouldn't have been possible without that exhibit and without Paul Philip Cook and without Louise Hutchinson and the Anacostia Museum. I also want to acknowledge Vivian May. She wrote a book in 2006, question mark, maybe 2009, called Anna Julia Cooper, Visionary Black Feminist. And that book is the most sustained treatment of Anna Julia Cooper's larger body of work. And Vivian May was a student of Beverly Guy Sheftall, who is the Anna Julia Cooper Professor of Women in Studies at Spelman College. And Vivian recalls taking a seminar with Beverly where she got, quote, bit by the Cooper bug. And so once that happens, like, that's it. You're studying Cooper for the rest of your life. So hopefully some of you will have that experience too. And I also want to thank Howard University. The Moreland Spingarn Research Center holds Cooper's papers, which we've recently digitized through the work of Joellen Albashir, Lopez Matthews, McKinney Johnson, Adrina Eiffel. And, you know, it was a labor of love. We pulled together, we did it pretty quickly, got the papers digitized, and now they're available to, you know, a global audience of scholars and students who want to learn more about Cooper. And I also want to thank my husband and my daughter who are here. They're also part of this process. My daughter helped me with the talk, gave me some coaching points, told me to be confident and brave, so I'm going to try to do that. That's it. So, again, I know that was a long preface, but I think it's important just to recognize that this work is cumulative. okay, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. And this is my clicker. Yes? Okay. Oh, okay. Let's see. There we go. Okay. It is hard to imagine today what was really at stake when Anna Julie Cooper in the late 19th, early 20th century advocated for a classical or liberal arts education for herself and her students. We have come in some ways to think of a liberal arts education as those courses we take in college while we are trying to determine what our real major will be. Or we might equate a classical education with reading the classic texts of Western literary tradition. And while reading classic texts is certainly part of a classical education, both classical and liberal arts education signify so much more. Historically, a classical education signified a schedule of study that included grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, and a liberal arts education was focused on educating the whole person to think and lead and participate fully in the social, political, and civic life of a society. For Cooper to argue at the dawning of the 20th century for access to a classical liberal arts education for herself and her students ran exactly counter to the currents in the national racial politics within the United States and the local politics within Washington, D.C. Nevertheless, and at great cost to herself, Cooper persisted in advocating for an education for all grounded in the liberal arts tradition, and in the process, she transformed the shape of black education in our nation's capital. Born into slavery in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1858, Anna Julia Cooper rose to prominence by century's end as one of the most influential voices on racial and gender equality in the United States. She was a nationally and internationally renowned speaker, author, community advocate, and educator whose work included her 1892 collection of essays, A Voice from the South, and challenged systems of oppression and sought to improve the lives of African Americans. As a child, she attended St. Augustine's Normal and Collegiate Institute before going on to earn a BA and MA in mathematics at Oberlin College. She taught for almost four decades at Dunbar High School, serving as principal for five of those years, and in 1925, she became only the fourth black woman in the U.S. to earn her PhD when she completed and defended her dissertation at the University of Paris-Sorbonne. At age 72, she took on the presidency of Freeling Hyson University, a group of community schools for Washington, D.C.'s black working class residents. When she retired from her position as president in 1940, she continued to serve as the institute's registrar until well into her 90s. Cooper lived until 1964, 105 years, almost all of which she devoted to advancing educational opportunities for African Americans. But Cooper's life story is so much more than accumulation of dates and facts. It is not just what she did, but it is how she did it, at what cost, and to what ends. It is not just what she accomplished, but what she overcame and what she made possible for others. Indeed, at 9 years of age, Cooper entered St. Augustine's Normal and Collegiate Institute in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it could be said that that is where she staged one of her earliest protests against the educational disparities she would go on to confront throughout her life. Founded in 1867 under the auspices of the Freedmen's Bureau and the Episcopal Church, St. Augustine's offered African Americans in Raleigh and surrounding areas access to both vocational and liberal arts training. This access, however, was not without its gender disparities, and Cooper had to petition for admittance into St. Augustine's courses in Greek and Latin, a protest she would successfully enact again when she found herself shut out of the, quote, gentlemen's courses when she arrived at Oberlin College several years later. Cooper recalls of her time at St. Augustine's, quote, a boy had only to declare a floating intention to study theology, and he could get all the support and courage and stimulus he needed, while a self-supporting girl had to struggle on by teaching in the summer and working after school hours to keep up with her board bills and actually to fight her way against positive discouragement to higher education. So here Cooper identifies two critical impediments to her educational advancement. One, the attempts to restrict her access to a full curriculum, and two, the lack of structural and particularly financial support for her educational pursuits. These two things will be critical in shaping her intellectual and activist agenda as she worked to pursue advanced educational opportunities for herself and others. And I want to pause here to note that it was not just that Cooper was protesting the fact that she herself had to work after hours in summers and to serve as a pupil teacher at age 10, but it was also, as she points out, the sacrifices that were made at home, in particular those of her mother, Hannah Stanley, who Cooper states, even after emancipation, was not, quote, released from self-sacrifice, and many an unbuttered crust was eaten in silent content that she might eke out enough from her poverty to send her young folks off to school. So later in life, when Cooper addresses the all-black male clergy of the Protestant Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C., she is not speaking in mere abstraction when she states, to be plain, I mean, let money be raised and scholarships be founded in our colleges and universities for self-supporting, worthy young women to offset and balance the aid that can always be found for a boy who will take theology. And she concludes, not the boys less, but the girls more. This pattern of protesting structural inequalities and advocating for social change and transformation will continue as Cooper translated her personal struggles to gain an equal education into her work as an intellectual, activist, teacher, and administrator. In 1887, she moved to Washington, D.C. to accept a position teaching mathematics and science at Washington's only black high school, the Washington Colored High School, known affectionately as M Street, and renamed Dunbar High School in 1917 in honor of poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. Founded in 1870, only 3 years after Howard University, M Street was a preeminent secondary school for black education in the country. It offered rigorous liberal arts education along with vocational training to prepare its graduates for trade jobs, careers as teachers, and most notably for pursuits in higher education. In 1902, at 44 years of age, Cooper became the seventh principal of M Street High School. When Cooper claimed her position as principal of M Street, the racial climate locally as well as nationally was fraught. It had only been 6 years since Plessy v. Ferguson had upheld racial segregation in public accommodation, including schools, and it would be another 52 years before Brown v. Board of Education would make segregation of public schools unconstitutional. So the entirety of her career in public education takes place under the shroud of legalized racial segregation. Add to this a shifting racial climate in the U.S. that saw the political and civic gains of Reconstruction met with a resurgence of racial violence and the withdrawal of federal support for protecting the rights and lives of African Americans. Indeed, this is the era that saw the ascendancy of Booker T. Washington and his Tuskegee model for industrial education. Washington's accommodationist approach, which emphasized training blacks for vocational and trade jobs, found enthusiastic supporters among white philanthropists and became the dominant, though not exclusive, model for black education. Running counter to this current, Cooper, in her position as principal, continued and expanded M Street's tradition of encouraging higher education among its students. As one of Cooper's early biographers, Paul Philip Cook, explains, Cooper succeeded in doing what white public schools in Washington, D.C. had not. She prepared her students to pass the entrance exams and gain admittance and scholarships to the top universities in the country. Under her leadership, M Street sent students to Harvard, Brown, Oberlin, Yale, Amherst, UPenn, Dartmouth, and Radcliffe, as well as prestigious black colleges and universities such as Fisk, Atlanta, and, of course, Howard. Her students scored the highest in the district on standardized tests, and her school, her intellect, and her administrative acumen received international acclaim when French scholar Felix Klein, touring U.S. schools at the invitation of Theodore Roosevelt, identified M Street as one of the most illustrious schools in the nation. In her 1934 history of Dunbar High School, fellow intellectual activist and longtime Washingtonian Mary Church Terrell credits Cooper with the transformation of education in Washington, D.C. Cooper, she notes, instituted a liberal arts curriculum, began placing students at prestigious colleges and universities, and earned accreditation for M Street from such esteemed institutions as Howard University. She did this in spite of resistance from the D.C. school board and the political machine that opposed liberal arts or classical education for African Americans, and she carried it out at great personal and professional cost. As Annie Easton, a former M Street student during those days, explained, if you could smell or feel or in any way sense the aura of D.C. in those days, you would know that it only took her daring in having her students accepted and given scholarships at Ivy League schools to know that the white power structure would be out to get her. When, for example, the white director of Washington High Schools, Percy Hughes, insisted Cooper teach the colored curriculum, she refused, for at least the third time in her life, to accept for herself or her students an inferior program of study. Instead, she waged what she referred to as the courageous revolt against a lower colored curriculum for M Street High School. Despite her best efforts and the swell of support from the local community, in 1906, Cooper was removed from her post as principal of M Street when the board voted not to reappoint her. She was effectively exiled from her home in Washington, D.C., and she was denied official recognition as the educational leader she was. As she explained in a letter written from Lincoln, Missouri in 1909, I served as principal of M Street High School for 5 years. In this work, I had the satisfaction of believing that I was able to encourage the efforts of higher development. I can only say that my labor in this direction met with appreciative recognition from the people I served. But they are lowly and, for the most part, voiceless. The dominant forces of our country are not yet tolerant of the higher steps for colored youth, so that while our course of study was for the time being saved, my head was lost in the fray. The M Street controversy, as it has more commonly come to be known, is often boiled down to a debate between W.E.B. Du Bois versus Booker T. Washington. This approach, however, diminishes Cooper's courageous role in advocating for liberal arts education for her students, as well as the ways in which her gender made her even more vulnerable, and the ways in which racism and sexism at the individual and structural levels worked to forestall black education and really to dissuade black excellence, or try to dissuade black excellence. After 5 years teaching at Lincoln Institute of Missouri, Cooper was called back to Washington, D.C. and resumed her position as a teacher at M Street. Though she would never again serve as principal, she continued to advance classical education for her students and to advocate for recognition of their achievements. In 1923, for example, Cooper put on a production of two scenes from the Aeneid. The production was exceptional for a number of reasons, including at the most fundamental level, as T.C. Jaji states, African-descended people were not expected to lay claim to the classics. Cooper's students' performance, not incidentally, focused on two scenes featuring Dido and set in Carthage, or modern-day Tunisia in North Africa. The African elements in the play are foregrounded, and as Monica Nduno explains, Cooper Africanized her production of the Aeneid by using Egyptian iconography in the set design and by highlighting references in the script to the presence and contributions of Africans in the Western world. As Nduno concludes, Cooper used drama as a way of informing students, performers, and audience about the larger contributions of black people to mankind, especially at points of intersection with Western classical civilization, thus illuminating a common ancestry and showing black people with a world history preceding slavery. Cooper was especially pleased with what the students and the community had been able to accomplish with such limited resources. Wanting to give the students the recognition that they deserved, Cooper wrote to W.E.B. Du Bois and sent him a picture of one of the students as Hecuba so that he might run a notice in Crisis magazine. Du Bois was editor of Crisis at this time. When Du Bois failed to do so, explaining that the photograph Cooper sent him was not particularly interesting and that he had had, quote, nothing of real interest about the play except for the short notice that she gave it, and that the general public was not, quote, much interested in that, Cooper fired back. According to me, Cooper says, and she quotes herself here, which I'd love, she would do that. You know, she's like, according to me, and so she's like, I'm a source of authority here. A thing of beauty cut from the classic contact of a people is interesting. Cooper goes on to remark that the student's performance, quote, illustrates some of the best work accomplished in the Dunbar High School, And she notes, our staging alone costs several hundred dollars, which is a good deal for poor folks and amateurs. I trust you will give the readers of The Crisis an opportunity to judge for themselves whether our effort is interesting. Underline, quotation marks. And I don't mean to, I don't bring that up just to point out that there was a tiff between Cooper and Du Bois, but it's really interesting, and I'm happy to talk about that later. But more to point out the degree to which Cooper was willing to go to advocate for her students. That her students could claim, participate in, engage directly, and transform a classic of Western civilization suggests one of the many ways their performance constituted an act of transformative resistance. As Vivian May asserts, Cooper held to the conviction that all forms of education should be sites of liberation, and she advocated a critical pedagogy where students and teachers would eschew models of learning based on rote memory, the uncritical reproduction of information, or facile imitation. Her students' performance thus served as an example of how Cooper brought education, activism, and art together as part of her social change agenda, and she sure believed that Du Bois should recognize this. While working full-time as a teacher, Cooper also continued pursuing her own education as well, but again, not without challenges and roadblocks. In 1925, she traveled to Paris under the duress of being fired from M Street to complete her doctoral degree. Though she had started her advanced studies in 1914 at Columbia University, when her brother died and she adopted his five grandchildren, she put her graduate studies on hold. Then, because M Street would not give her leave, she was unable to fulfill the residency requirement to complete her degree at Columbia University. With the assistance of Felix Klein, who had written that glowing review of M Street 20 years earlier, she transferred her credits to the University of Paris Sorbonne, where she wrote a new doctoral thesis in French on France's attitudes towards slavery during the French and Haitian revolutions, which she defended also in French in Paris, the heart of intellectual, you know, French intellectual cultural life. So, you know, and that's another thing we can talk about later as well, is the degree to which Cooper was willing to go into this space and, you know, this kind of seat of cultural intellectual power and to talk to them about what they needed to do to recognize how slavery had shaped their history as well. And her examiners, you know, took her to task for it, and she took them to task right back. Later in life, Cooper would serve, am I missing a scene? There's Cooper, that's her dissertation on the left, and there she is in her doctoral regalia on the right. Later in life, Cooper would serve as president of Freleng-Hyssing University, founded in 1906 as a group of community schools to provide continuing education for working black adults in Washington, D.C. As Leona Gable explains, Freleng-Hyssing was an effort to fill a serious need. Out of the seven full-time universities in Washington, there was but one black institution, and a list of 88 part-time colleges and special schools, not one would admit African Americans. When the D.C. Board of Education refused Freleng-Hyssing the right to grant bachelor's degrees and funds became increasingly tight, Cooper appealed to the NAACP to support it. She felt it was the duty and responsibility of the community to do so. When they did not, she moved portions of the administrative and teaching services into her T Street home. As Paul Philip Cook states, Freleng-Hyssing served an important function in Washington, D.C. in its own right, while also propelling other schools in the district to make continuing and adult education part of their curriculum. As much as Cooper rose to prominence, as my somewhat brief comments today illustrate, she was still and always working from the margins. And while Cooper was extraordinary, she was not singular. She worked within a community of men and women, some of whom she closely aligned, others with whom she held productive differences. She accomplished much, but she did not win all of her battles. Racism and sexism curtailed some of her most ambitious projects. She had wanted to write a history of African Americans in Washington, D.C. Who might be better to write that history than Cooper? But yet she was denied funds for such a project when she applied to the Brookings Institute for support. Nevertheless, the legacy she leaves is greater than defeats doled out on the basis of race and gender. She honored the humanistic impulse and saw education as a vehicle to answer the innate longings of each individual for self-realization and the highest expressions of freedom. She believed that an awakening of the individual consciousness could give rise to individual and social transformation. She advocated for the ideological but also material support for especially black girls and women, but for all people dispossessed from seats of power and privilege. She advocated for, wrote in support of, and utilized in her classrooms a pedagogical approach that pushed back against the dehumanizing curriculum of the machine age that relied on efficiency and rote memorization and was producing workers instead of educating men and women. She transformed black education in D.C. by creating a steady stream of black students into the Ivy Leagues. Sorry, I just lost my place. Also by creating community schools that put pressure on other institutions to create continuing education programs, and by modeling and inspiring at the very core of all of her work, education and service to the greater good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was outstanding. I can't wait to discuss that. Our next speaker is Dr. Kara Olivia Heron. Dr. Heron is a highly decorated and accomplished scholar and classicist with accolades too numerous to list in full at the moment, but includes the Elizabeth Stone Memorial Award, I'm going to mispronounce it, the Bechol Leshan Media Award, a Fulbright Fellowship, and more. She is an author and educator and the founder of Epic Center Stories. Kara Olivia writes fiction, nonfiction, song lyrics, opera, and books for children, including Nappy Hair. She has held professorial appointments at Harvard University, at Mount Holyoke College, Cal State, the College of William and Mary, and Arizona State University. She is currently a professor in Howard University's Department of Classics, teaching courses such as Blacks in Antiquity. And when we were speaking before this presentation, I was telling her how jealous I am of her students after I looked at the curriculum of her courses. They're really outstanding. She also hosts her weekly radio program, Epic City, which you can hear at 4 p.m. on Tuesdays on Tacoma Radio 94.3. She can be found seemingly everywhere and anywhere. There are scholarly pursuits happening in D.C., and Dr. Heron's family has strong and direct ties throughout our city, and particularly with Dr. Cooper, whose influence inspires Dr. Heron's work today. Please welcome Dr. Kara Olivia Heron.
Okay. I want to start by saying that so many of the names that you use in your talk were household names. I grew up with my grandmother and her siblings and so forth. All knew Anna Julia Cooper. They knew Terrell. They knew Mary McLeod Bethune. It was like all the educators in D.C. seemed to be godparents to my uncles and aunts. So it's always weird for me to switch my brain and I say, oh, they're famous out there. But that's Aunt Susie. You know, they're close friends. My mother talks about being placed on the lap of Mary McLeod Bethune and different little things like that that are part of growing up. And we're poor enough, but I guess you could say the black intelligentsia class, if you will, in Washington, D.C. And I also wanted to make a statement in honor of Ben. I said your name wrong the first time. Now I want to make sure I get it right the second time. Payne. That I know you did some work within a classic school in Atlanta and had some problems there. Well, I want you to know the city of Atlanta asked for to purchase 4,000 copies of my book, Nappy Hair, and seemed to be rejecting the classics, having no idea that the book, Nappy Hair, was written as a part of my comparative epic class at Harvard University, in which I taught the Iliad and the Odyssey and all those kinds of books, because it is in the direct tradition of the classical epics. And so I feel like I have to say that in case it doesn't fit in somewhere. I want you to know that as a group. Well, I am going to basically tell you about my family's strive toward education, and Anna Julia Cooper will come in and out. I'll be ending with talking about the Harbor of Ethiopia, an African-American epic that I would not have discovered if I had not been inspired by Anna Julia Cooper. From Roanoke to Bridgewater, I had an ancestor, 1858, ran away from slavery in Roanoke, Virginia. She had white skin, so she didn't have to take the Underground Railroad, she used the Overground Railroad. She actually was at a school for white young ladies and didn't know that she was black until she came home unexpectedly and found out, and her white slave owner father told her who she was, that sort of thing. A compromise was made, mother and father, the slave mother and the slave-owning white father. She was given a bunch of money, put on a train, went to Massachusetts, and lived among the Wampanoag people, Native Americans in Massachusetts, and made a decision. She was so mad about slavery that she was determined to turn her family black. She said, I have a little story called From White to Black in Three Generations. And she essentially, she was pretty oppressive, it sounds like to me. All of her daughters marry the cold blackest people they could find, and that's from whom I got my wonderful nappy hair. It's white now, but it wasn't always white. Okay, so that's the beginning of the story. She was very much into education. She was in school when she found out about her education, having essentially a classical girl's education, my parents. Both of my parents and my mother's side in particular, always quoting Latin phrases and things around me. It was a part of my life. My grandmother went to Harper's Ferry, which of course we associate with revolution, with John Brown and so forth. That's where she met my grandfather, who was from Jamaica, and they married. Both of my grandparents graduated from college in the early 1900s. This is unusual for anybody in the United States, let alone a black family, to have two people graduating from college so early. And my grandfather actually was a professor for a short while at Storer College in West Virginia. They met at Hilltop House. Some of you may have gone there. It's still there, I'm told. And I have the white to black, the three generations. Okay. I'm just listing some of the friends, Mary McLeod Bethune, Anna Julia Cooper, Eliza Pearl Shippen was, she's the one who created the Deltas. She's like my mother's godmother. She's like a household name, Bessie Parker. My mother described crying, going to school every day because she had to cross a railroad track out in Kenilworth neighborhood here in Washington, D.C., and she had to go past the white school to go to the black school, which is now Carver Elementary, and thinking about, and her own desire to be educated and outraged by, even at that young age, having to go to school in that way. My mother was a graduate of Dunbar High School and was there after Anna Julia Cooper, but knew all about her and of course had heard about her through her mother, my grandmother, as well, and learned Latin and studied Latin and was a Latin scholar there. And she even studied, I'm told, Anglo. She did. She used to recite Chaucer, Middle English, to me, and that sort of thing, from high school. It was at M Street School that she met Marian Anderson. She met Eleanor Roosevelt, and you can read about that or see that if you ever see my opera. I have it. I've made it into the opera Marian Anderson, Let Freedom Sing, the story of Marian Anderson. This is actually the 80th anniversary of her, this year, of her concert on the Mall in 1939. and we're hoping to do something about that at Howard University in April. Okay, so I guess I want to finish my parents' life, and then I get to the Anna Julia Cooper in my life, so bear with me. My mother graduated from M Street School, which was Dunbar High School by that time, and got two letters in the mail, one offering her a big job, as they thought, in the federal government, and the other to go to college. It was Minor Teachers College, and her mother had always wanted to be a teacher. And everybody said, oh, if you go into the government, you'll make so much money, you'll be rich, you'll be this, that, and the other. And everybody was begging her to go for the government job. And she said she went into the bedroom and cried and cried and cried and cried. And her mother said, you want to be a teacher, go be a teacher. And the whole family capitulated, as it were, and she gave up the rich job, as it seemed to them then, and went on to be a teacher and through what is now the University of District of Columbia. And I can just to finish up that story, she's still with us in the world. She's 94 years old. She became a super science teacher in Washington, D.C., and I guess one of the funniest moments of my life was when I was a brand new, newly minted professor at Harvard University, right? I thought I was hot stuff. I was walking across, the yard and thought, I'm really something, you know? And then some kid comes running across the yard, Professor Heron, Professor Heron. I said, what? Yes, yes, what are you, what? Are you Miss Heron's daughter? I said, oh, no, is that all this stuff I've done, and my Miss Heron's daughter. He had taken science from my mother at Lafayette Elementary School and was thanking me for my mother. But that's what happens, you know. You can't follow after some people. Okay, well, I surrounded by all of this education and classic education. My father was in love with epic heroes. I'm an epicist, if you will. My nickname is the epicentrist because I'm always into epics and talking about epics. And even when I'm trying to talk about something else, I'm talking about epics. And I can remember walking, my first contact with Anna Julia Cooper was just walking by her house and seeing the area where she lived, because on T Street is the house where there were lots of elite black people lived in. I didn't live there. I was like, second, third, fourth tier. But they were like the Mayor Washington married into the Bullock family. The Bullocks were pastors of my mother's church, Third Baptist Church, superstars kind of thing. And I was considered smart enough. They had a daughter. I was considered smart enough. They would come all the way out to Northeast and get me to come play with their daughter because they wanted their daughter to play with somebody smart. So that was my experience of T Street. And so I would go up and down T Street, and Mayor Washington, you may know, lived on T Street, 508 T Street. I used to go in there and play with Mayor Washington's daughter. and that was a part of my life. So I was familiar with her name then. And there are a couple of scenes. I think of the concept of hiding in order to learn. This is the, if I may distill the Anna Julia Cooper in my life, it's hiding somewhere so that you could learn something. I went to Neville Thomas Elementary School in Northeast in Mayfair Mansions neighborhood, and when I finished all the work for all sixth grades, by the time I finished the first grade, I just sat in the corner for the 6 years. I didn't do much of anything. I had to, they didn't know what to do. There was no school they could send me to. And thinking about, and I want to jump to something you said, by the way, things are coming to my mind. You stir so much. My father actually had the highest recorded scores in IQ in Washington, D.C., and there was nothing they could do with him. There's no place to send him, no school, no place, no encouragement, and no money. He didn't want to be a preacher, and if you don't want to be a preacher, you had nothing. You had no way you could go for further. So that really struck me when you talked about it. And that his education was through the Dunbar High School, through that high education, very high education. So hiding to learn when we're supposed to be at recess, running into the school and sneaking up to the sixth grade room and reading the books that you're not supposed to be able to read yet and finishing them all up. And my mind was, in a way, was getting ready for the Anna Julia Cooper story, I feel, that affected me so much in the research part of my life. Because when I found out that they wouldn't let her learn Greek and Latin, which I wanted to learn so much. And I can tell you, in my high school, Coolidge High School, our Latin teacher would not allow the black students to come in through the front door. We had to go through the back door. The white students went in through the front door. And if you wanted to learn Latin, you had to want it a lot because you had to endure the insult of going into the back door. I remember trying to go in through the front door once. She just stood there and wouldn't let me through. But I wanted to learn it so bad that I put up with that insult and went in through the back. And she would teach Latin 4 days a week, and on Friday she would teach Greek. And I actually preferred the Greek, and so I would just wait for Friday so we could learn a little bit of Greek. And that was like a joy for me, fighting to be educated. There was a person in the neighborhood where my mother grew up in Kenilworth, Charles Thomas. He was actually the dean of Minor Teachers College, another product of Paul Cook and the people you've been mentioning. Paul Cook is a good friend of mine. I visited him many times, and so it's just like, I can't believe you're talking about my friend. So I didn't realize that Harvard was a white school, because there was this black man on our street. Everybody said was the smartest man in the world. Okay, he's Dr. Charles Thomas. He had very dark skin. And there was a joke that I didn't quite understand about him, in which he would, there'd be a big occasion and everybody would wear their robes, and he would wear his Harvard robe, which of course was red. And there was an idea then that dark-skinned people should not wear bright red. And somebody who didn't understand that Harvard was a prestigious school said to somebody else in the group, why would they put the red robe on Charlie? Because he's so dark. And it was like a big joke in the family that this poor, stupid person didn't know that this was an honor, and that in this case, the usual don't let black people wear red didn't fit. Well, I didn't understand any of that. I didn't understand colorism. I was clueless. And I thought that meant that you had to have really dark skin to go to the school where the smartest person in the world. So I remember sitting on the wall across from his house on Jefferson Street and wishing I was really, really black so I could go to this school called Harvard. And that way I could go where the smartest man in the world used to go. I got to tell this story at his funeral and share it for the first time with his wider family. It was a lot of laughter about that. He actually visited me at Harvard one time in my office there before he died, which was also a joy. So this is all the background I want before I get to the what did Anna Julia Cooper do in my life. I was told that there's no such thing as African American epic. Almost all the genres of African American poetry occur for black people at the same time as they occur for white people. And black people are writing romantic poetry when white people are writing romantic poetry, and back and forth and so forth. And most American epics are written around the Revolutionary War, and you don't find any African American epics around the Revolutionary War. So people said they didn't exist. And I just felt like I was really depressed. I felt like the epic impulse is everywhere, and they have to exist. We'll get that back when I need it. We don't need it right now. And so I was sort of wandering around libraries and digging up old things and happened upon Anna Julia Cooper's A Voice from the South and read about her sitting in the back of the room hiding under a table. I mean, she was learning Greek under a table and won't say what word is in my head, in the front with the table available to them weren't learning a thing, and she had it all. And I thought, well, I'm just going to take this from her. And I remember just reading that and I said, I'm making the decision that African American epics exist. I'm ignoring everybody that tells me it doesn't exist. I just decided it. I don't care what they say. And so now, okay, where is it? And so I started going to libraries, and I did, instead of saying, I don't know if this exists and can I look at this, that, I just decided that it was there. And I went to the rare book rooms in the Library of Congress, and I got a wonderful fellowship to the Beinecke Library at Yale. couldn't find a thing there. I did find a book, 1835. That was my first clue that there was something there. 1835, John Boyd wrote an epic in Miltonic blank verse from the Bahamas called A Vision. Aha! So if I feel a desire for this, other people must have felt it at some time, so let me find this stuff. So I couldn't find it, and I got this wonderful fellowship, the Beinecke, went up and down everything, went through all the catalogs, nothing. And every day I would be in the library feeling depressed because I was spending their money and enjoying that part, but I could find nothing. I would pass by these great big piles of catalogs that said miscellaneous. Miscellaneous. I said, well, I'm not finding anything else. I might as well see what miscellaneous is. So I pull out the miscellaneous, and lo and behold, some amazing person way back when is just collecting epic poems from all over the place, 10 at a time, sticks them in a binder, puts them on the shelf and calls it miscellaneous. And like there are like 100, 200 of them. And most of them are about white people, but I find like 20 by black people. And he just sticks them in there, and it's under miscellaneous. And I'm thinking, wow, and I found my stuff. And it was like, I think Anna Julia Cooper was there. I don't have to be a scholar. Like, I can be a novelist kind of person and say, I think there was a spirit there helping me out. And I couldn't believe the joy I found with finding these epics. And they're about everything under the sun. Some of them use Milton, some of them use Homer, some of them use Germanic epics, the Faust story as their foundations, and elaborating stories about African Americans. Many of them use, about half of them use Abraham Lincoln as a hero. It's almost as if there's a certain kind of sadness in this. You find them just struggling to figure out, who is the hero? Who is the hero? And I have this picture in my head that they were sitting at a window and escaping slaves are running past the window, and they're thinking, who is the hero? And they can't see, you know, that the hero was right there among us and a part of them. So many of them have those kinds of stories. But can we get the one I found at the end, by Maurice Corbett. Is it? Sorry about that. It's because I wasn't using it enough, so it didn't like what I was doing. Among other things, called The Harp of Ethiopia. Not only does it talk about the history of African Americans and Africans in the world, I guess I can't make it do something. Okay, yeah, Maurice Corbett there. And if you look at it a little bit further, it'll tell you the heroic deeds of their leaders and ancestral progenitors, their trials and difficulties, all sorts of wonderful things, trying to tell the African story, the African-American story, the Ethiopian story, but also in the rhythms themselves, finally getting away from strictly European rhythms and using some African-derived rhythms, jazz rhythms, syncopated rhythms, that sort of thing. And it's just a wonderful experience to go from 1835 to, I'm sorry, it's 1910, forgive me, I've forgotten the exact years on there, it's in the early 1900s. So this, I feel that's what Anna Julia Cooper gave me, and there has to be, the idea that there has to be an African-American epic. And if you actually, I don't know how to get to the page, but if you go back far enough, let me see if I can find it. You know, we scholars don't get much in this world, but the entry in the catalog, I'm sorry, I don't know how to, without the computer, says American, African, American, and epic. That did not exist before my work. It's like, yes, Anna Julia Cooper and I did that. Can you see it? The word African, American, and epic did not occur in the same place before this work. So this is what she did. this is what I did, and this is what I feel is the contribution that I have, I feel like I've helped to make as a part of the tradition of insisting that there is a classical tradition in our culture, in our lives. And I, I think that is what I wanted to share with you. Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Can you hear? Oh, you can hear me. Okay, I know you can hear me. If anyone has a question, please, for either Dr. Heron or for Dr. Moody Turner. If not, I'm going to be selfish and ask all the questions. So I have a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please.
Hi. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed both of these presentations. And I have a question about, for both of you, if you know this, but I think Dr. Moody Turner, if you could maybe answer first, what was the relationship between Anna Julia Cooper and Margaret Murray Washington? Because I know that they were both teaching. Mm-hmm. Cooper was older, I believe. But I'd love to, because I know you kind of drew out the tension between Du Bois and Washington. I thought, what about the women? Yeah. Thank you.
That's a good question. I haven't found a lot that documents the two of them in direct conversation in any way, but they were definitely in overlapping circles. So Cooper was working with, where's Nazira, the Colored Women League in Washington, D.C., Colored Women's League, and I can't remember the exact name. They change names, but eventually they come together, and it's the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. And so Margaret Murray Washington was active in that, and so they would have been working together on similar projects. So I don't find anything that documents any real animosity. What's interesting, though, is a lot of people one of the people have looked at is Mary Church Terrell, and have thought, well, Cooper and Mary Church Terrell went to Oberlin together. They're in D.C. This whole thing happens with M Street. Mary Church Terrell doesn't really come out and say a whole lot at that time, and why is that? Cooper actually replaces Robert Terrell after he moves on to a different position. She's principal right after him. And so, you know, there was all kinds of speculation that they didn't get along or that they're husbands, but I'm hesitant about that because I think there were all kinds of politics going on, and a lot of the women ended up working together when their interests and needs kind of intersected. And I don't know that, you know, for Mary Churchill, I don't know that it would have done much for her to say something at that point to come out in defense of Cooper in that moment. And I find evidence later that they did work together and that, you know, Mary Church Terrell writes about Cooper as being this transformative force in black education when she writes the history of Washington, D.C. But one thing, I'll just say one more thing to that really quickly, is that the period of the 1890s really sees this kind of ferment of black women's political and intellectual activity. And in some ways that gets answered. In like 1900, a lot of those avenues start getting shut down. So Cooper gets excommunicated from M Street. Mary Church Terrell is having problems getting her work published and printed in mainstream press. Pauline Hopkins gets pushed out of Colored American Magazine by the same kind of Tuskegee machine that was behind Cooper's. And Ida B. Wells gets ostracized in the NAACP. And so in some ways there's this kind of reaction against this black way. I don't know if it's a direct reaction, but they end up having vehicles that have been open to them for political activity kind of curtailed. And they start looking for and finding alternative spaces to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for your lectures. I'm really interested in the idea of the miscellaneous folder, and also in relationship to that idea of a miscellaneous folder and what you can find in that. In particular, Shirley, when you're digitizing the Cooper archive, then what are the other materials that you found, such as Cooper's autograph album, her...
The same collection that Mary Washington, that she edited, the 40-volume Schomburg collection.
Oh, Gates, yeah.
Yeah, Gates. I did one of the books for that.
Mm-hmm.
I did the one on Angelina Weld Grimke. And to speak sort of to your question, although it's not about Cooper directly, of those 40 books, 39 of them were books that were already finished. The editor just had to read the book and write an essay for it. Of course, the one I had to do was scattered all over Moreland's Rincon and New York City and everywhere else, and I had to pull it together. And I really had to fight with Skip Gates because he wanted to call it the complete works of Angelina Weld Grimke. There's no way it could be complete. I was looking at the backs of envelopes and turning envelopes inside out and napkins that were from you know, coffee shops. And I read all the letters. She's the first lesbian. As far as I know, I don't know if there's somebody found somebody earlier than that that we know of, African-American lesbian, where I saw all the letters where she crossed out the she's and put he's in there for publication. Well, I didn't publish both versions. You know, they chose to publish, you know, the most recent version of it. But I can say that I tried to get everything, but there's no way it's everything is there. And I've actually tried to get somebody needs to go there and do a better job so that we can call it complete, but it is not so. But you did that as well. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about saying, you know, just making a decision that it should be there, so it has to be there,
mm-hmm.
and that literally is a method. Like mm-hmm. that's a method of research.
Yeah.
You know, I've done that with Cooper a number of times where I'm like, she's working with Celestine Boublé, who's this famous French sociologist, and there have to be correspondences between mm-hmm. the two. Like, they have to be
there.
They
have to be there.
You know, mm-hmm. and so it's a matter of, like, going, mm-hmm. journeying to the spot and, mm-hmm. you know, looking in unlikely places in archives, but also, you know, in attics and in conversations.
Yeah.
Like, just in conversations, you know, thinking about the conversations you've had with your family and learning more about Cooper and the test.
Well, the more I hear you and others like you, if you will, there are not too many, I don't know if there's anybody like you, but but you know what I mean, people are referring to these. I realize that the background noise of my childhood is a play, is a novel, is a book, is something I never realized. I don't know, Murray Church, you'll fall asleep, and you don't realize these are people that are so important later on. And as I get older, they rise and rise and rise, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, she was down the street, and she was my Uncle Jack's godmother, and, you know, that sort of thing. I would love to have a drama, that, mm-hmm. say, of a coffee shop or you know, I don't know, boudoir, anyway. Have them all talking together. It'd be wonderful.
You have a project.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say one more thing about your question. Because for me, the next book I'm working on is called Shadow Writings. And so, not called Shadow Writings, it's about Shadow Writings. And not only is it a matter of looking for works that, you know, exist outside of the published book, like you were saying, the work you've done on our autograph albums and the stories that they tell. Mm-hmm. So it's not only finding the items, but also the way you, I've seen her autograph albums before. When I heard you give your talk on them, I was like, wow, I didn't mm-hmm. see all that. You know, and so having new ways of reading these materials too, You know, people say Cooper wrote one book, really, Voice from the South, but what about her scrapbook? Is that a book or is it not a book? Why can't we count that as another book? She wrote articles for the Washington Bee and the Washington and the Afro-American, and she cut them out and pasted them into a book. And the articles are all about discriminatory practices against workers, about this machine age production, critiques of an kind of rote education, and they're pasted over this book that's telling the story of the rise of Standard Oil and industrial capitalism. You know, like, you don't think there's a conversation going on there? There's a conversation going on there. You know, and so learning how to read these kinds of subversive practices that they're doing to get this material. And then the last thing I'll say about that is it's also about reading the stuff that doesn't even exist. And, you know, when Cooper published Voice from the South 2 years later, Alice Bacon, founder of the Hampton Folklore Society, said, you know, we are so excited that Cooper has another book on the way.
Oh, no. That drives you crazy.
You know, and that's it.
Because you can't find it.
Yeah, and did she ever write it? Is it gone? The story of Washington, D.C. that she would have written, mm-hmm. what would that story be from Anna Julia Cooper living her whole life, you know, in D.C.? But she didn't get the funding, and so she didn't write that story. So I think there's just a whole different way of reading Black women's
Yes, and I, no, I have to add to that because before Phyllis Wheatley died, we were told that she had the manuscript of a second book. I have dreams of going through Boston and digging up her grave and finding them under her bones, bringing them back to the light. It's like, I found it. And then I wake up and I'm just here in D.C. and it's like, oh no. And it is, if you get the researcher's bug, you got it. And there's nothing you can do about it. You got to keep wanting to find it.
Mm-hmm. Ma'am, in the back.
Thank you so much for both of your presentations. And my question is for Dr. Turner, and it's two questions that I'm going to pretend link together. The first, because so I think you mentioned being bit by the Cooper bug, and I was recently bit by the bug, and I've read a whole bunch of her stuff, and there were two things that stood out to me that tie back to as we're talking about education today. And the first one is you mentioned that she kind of rejects this rote memorization mm-hmm. kind of strict way that school was taught, and the reason that is interesting now is when we talk about classical education, often what people are talking about is they think about the grammar, the recitation, all that, which is part of the classical education that Cooper espouses, classicism and the liberal education. Can you talk a little bit about that contrast between what she is pushing back again with what she views as classical with kind of what we talk about now when we view classical? And the second question is, I was really struck in her writings by how going back and forth you have writings that very much fit with what everyone talks about when we talk about Black feminism, and then you have writings where she really elevates and praises kind of the sphere of domesticity, and I don't think it's just because of the period when she's writing, but she really views the home as this powerful tool, and I know she constantly opened her own home up to her mm-hmm. students and extended education, but could you talk a little bit about the tension of how she reconciled kind of an education for women with this emphasis on the home, and then how she viewed classical education as moving beyond this rote memorization, even though we often talk about that in relation to the classical liberal education.
Two very, very good questions, big questions. So I think, you know, we don't know exactly how she was teaching, you know, what it looked like in the day-to-day, you know, curriculum in the classroom necessarily, but we have kind of glimpses into that, and I think the play is a really interesting example for me of that, right? Like there's a way in which, okay, you learn, you know, you need the kind of grammar, you need the language to be able to engage, but that doesn't mean that you are accepting that uncritically, right, or unconsciously. And so I think even looking at the play is like, okay, you're going to read the Aeneid, but what you're going to be doing is so different, right? And I'm not a classicist,
I need that play in my class. I need to do this.
But, you know, what she chose to focus, like where you choose to focus, I think is really important. What elements you choose to look at, how she's seeing, you know, teaching her students to read in that, the kind of, do a kind of against the grain, maybe reading of that. So I think that's part of what she was doing. She also, which is really interesting, is she, one of the, when, how I came to Cooper was I was doing work on the Hampton Folklorists, and I found Cooper hanging out with a bunch of folklorists in, like, you know, Hampton, Virginia. And I was like, wait, what's Cooper doing in Hampton, Virginia? Like, you know, this picture, this a kind of iconized picture we have of her didn't really fit with that model, and yet there she was, you know, in Hampton, Virginia. And when she, I love the story. She goes to a meeting of the Hampton Folklore Society. They have the president of the all-white American Folklore Society, William Wells Newell, addressing the students, and he's telling them that soon they will throw off all of their kind of particularities and they will join the great race of humans, you know, once they can kind of get rid of all that kind of specific stuff and just be human, you know, be human race. So Cooper gets up right after him and says, you know, you should appreciate that which is closest to you. You need to cultivate a respect for your own traditions, your own stories, that which is nearest. And she tells them, literally, there is material here as great as ever inspired Homer or Virgil. And that is what is going to give life to your engagement, right? And so I think it's very different than saying, okay, you're going to read this and kind of memorize it. But she's really trying to think about, I think always, she how they embody that space. And I think she does that in her writing. You know, people, my advisor, Mary Helen, wrote one of the lines that says, you know, Cooper was kind of, had this elevated rhetoric and was kind of speaking for, but not always to, kind of working class black women. And a lot of people have kind of taken up a critique of that and saying, well, she's talking across multiple registers. You know, she's always talking across multiple registers. You know, biblical allusions and references, her audiences would have, you know, black working class audiences would have gotten that, you know. And so I think that she knew ways to embody different discourses and how to kind of speak across registers. And the home question, there's more. Okay, the home question. I think she didn't want to, and people who've read Cooper and know Cooper, you can jump in and, you know, fill in, but I think she didn't want to completely collect, I don't think she had essentialized views of this is male sphere and this is female sphere, but I think she did want to say that there are distinctions, not that you don't move across them, not that they're kind of gendered binary spheres, but that there was something to be said for the work that had to be done in the home. That work was important, right? And so I think she's moving always. You know, I don't think it's like centered here. I think it's part of a very vast network of space across which she moved.
Sir.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, my question is short.
Welcome back. That was a panel discussion on the lifetimes and contributions of Anna Julia Cooper, who lived for nearly 106 years, made a profound contribution to African-American history, literature, education, and, of course, politics through Pan-Africanism and other forms of resistance. And that is going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, March 9th, 2024. March is Women's History, the Women's History Month, and we are going to continue to bring special features in that regard here at the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website, and that's at the Pan-African Radio Network. The Pan-African Radio Network can be reached at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And if you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. www.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Phyllis Hyman from the 1995 album entitled I Refuse to Be Lonely. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Like I want to, can't hold you to the promises you made. You won't be here tonight or any other night. It would be like say I'm not afraid, but to be I'm
sun is shining again. Now I'm waiting for the last tear to fall. I've gotta put the past behind me and get on.
is real.